It was 80 years ago today that my father, then an 18-year-old teenage boy, young man, was getting ready to go to college. Now, that was unique, quite frankly, because he would have been the first in his family ever to go to college. The reason he was able to do so is he got a college football scholarship. He was ready to go to what would be the equivalent of what we often call a Division I university. And everything seemed set in his life. But you know what happened 80 years ago today. Pearl Harbor was attacked. It was a day in infamy. My father recalls hearing about Pearl Harbor on the radio and made a decision that was immediate and that would affect his life and the life of his descendants, including me. My dad said, going to college is my dream. Fighting for my country is my responsibility. So he signed up for the Army Air Corps, and he became a part of World War II. He flew in the B-24 Liberator. He recalls flying over Normandy Beach during that day, which was such an incredible day of tragedy and yet victory at the same time. He remembers the bodies that he could see from up high looking down on Normandy Beach on D-Day. He would occasionally tell me stories, but most of the time he was hesitant to talk because it was so deeply emotional to him. He was a top turret gunner. For those of you who know anything about a B-24 Liberator or some similar type of airplane, it's a very dangerous position. Basically, you are protruding above at the highest level of the plane. And many times the bullets or the flak will come into there. He was wounded twice, two Purple Hearts. One time it almost killed him. And yet he continued to fight for his country. My dad died at a relatively young age. I was in my mid-20s when he was on his deathbed. And as I was sitting with him, he said, I need to tell you something. I wasn't sure what was about to happen. I knew that he was fine with the Lord. He was confident in his salvation. I was confident in his salvation. But for him, there was this look of sobriety that even surpassed what I had seen on his deathbed. He said, I want to tell you something that I should have told you a long time ago. But I did not tell you because I did not want you to have a burden of responsibility that you thought you had to live up to. He said, and this is my paraphrase, Tom, when I began to go into training and I knew that I was going to be in that airplane and I knew that the possibilities of my returning were not necessarily good, I made a commitment to God, not a deal with God, not if God, if you do this, then I'll do this. I just made a commitment to God. He said, I had not proposed to your mother yet. She thought I would have by this time, but I did not want to leave her a widow. And so I was not going to propose unless I was able to come back. And of course, she waited on him, and obviously he made it back. But this is the story he told me. He said, Tom, as I was about to go on our first mission, knowing that many of the flights had been shot down, I made a commitment to God, and that commitment was this. God, this is not a deal. You can take my life, or you can spare it. But if you choose to spare it, and I go back and marry Nan, I will commit my children to the service of the Lord. He looked at me, and he said, you are the blessing. Wow. I just looked at him with tears flowing down my eyes, and I said, I never knew. He said, I want you to know now because I want you to know that God will bless your life. He died about 10 days later. But obviously, that story, that powerful deathbed conversation became a part of who I am, who my three sons are, who my 11 grandchildren are, And the influence continues on and on today. I think about this man's life, Sam Rainer. I think about the fact that he was willing to do whatever God wanted him to do, live or die. And he knew that God was going to take care of him. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe you're not going to hear all the statistics. As my middle son says, you bore people to death, Dad. Can you please go in another direction? Maybe you won't remember some of the trends that I shared, but would you please consider coming away from this evening with this? God's got you, and he's got another chapter for you, and he's not done with you. And why not say that the best days are yet ahead? There was a man who was supposed to be building the house of God. In fact, he had started rebuilding the house. He was the kind of the political leader of the day. He was named Zerubbabel, really a weird name. I mean, how many kids name their kids Zerubbabel today? We got a lot of biblical names, but not Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was the weak but well-intending governor of Judah. It was the post-exile. It was about 500 years before the birth of Christ, and the people, the Jews, had been allowed by the then Persian government to return back to their homeland, specifically Jerusalem, and a ragtag remnant did return. And what did they find? When they walked into Jerusalem, the walls were down. When they walked into Jerusalem, the homes, some that were actually in the walls, were non-existent. The town was in ruins, and as they walked toward the center, the beloved temple was no more. God had a message for those Jews. Rebuild the house of God. Rebuild the house of God. Catch that analogy. Catch the comparison. Catch what God is telling us today. Rebuild the house of God. Zerubbabel politically was supposed to lead it as the political leader. Zechariah as the priestly leader was supposed to be the inspiration behind it. And yet these two men, for what reasons, we don't have all the details, built the foundation of the house of the Lord. But then, as we find out in Haggai, they abandoned the work. And so this is what happens in Zechariah chapter 4. An angel of the Lord is giving the priest Zechariah a series of visions. But this vision is specifically for Zerubbabel. Now catch that, if you will. The vision was for the man who did not receive it. The vision came to Zechariah. Why? Because he's the priest. Or perhaps was it that Zerubbabel, the political leader, the weak governor of Judah, was fearful and he stopped rebuilding the house of God? And God probably thought, I don't want to read too much between the lines of Scripture, but God probably thought, you're not listening to me, Zerubbabel. So I'm going to get a message to Zechariah, who will get a message to you. Let's just read that for a moment in Zechariah chapter 4. We'll just read the entirety of the chapter. It won't take that long. Then the angel who had been talking with me returned and woke me as though I had been asleep. What do you see now? I answered, I see a solid gold lampstand with a bowl of oil on top of it. Around the bowl are seven lamps, each having seven spouts with wicks. And I see two olive trees, one on each side of the bowl. Then I asked the angel, what are these, my Lord? What do they mean? Don't you know, the angel asked. No, my Lord, I replied. Then he said to me, this is what the Lord says to Zerubbabel. It is not by might nor by strength, but by my spirit, says the Lord of heaven's armies. Nothing, not even a mighty mountain, will stand in Zerubbabel's way. It will come like a level plain before him. When Zerubbabel sets the final stone of the temple in place, the people will shout, may God bless it, may God bless it. Then another message came to me from the Lord. Zerubbabel is the one who laid the foundation of this temple, and he will complete it. Then you will know that the Lord of heaven's armies has sent me. Do not despise these small beginnings, for the Lord rejoices to see the work begin, to see the plumb line in Zerubbabel's hands. The seven lamps represent the eyes of the Lord that search all around the world. Then I asked the angel, what are these two olive trees on each side of the lampstand? And what are the two olive branches that pour out golden oil through the two gold tubes? Don't you know? He asked. No, my Lord. Then he said, they represent the two anointed ones who stand in the court of the Lord of all the earth. We could spend hours looking at this imagery. We could literally park here for weeks. We can see the significance of some of it because we see the number seven repeatedly. And that, of course, is the number of God, the number of completion, the number of wholeness. In fact, the angel of the Lord who is speaking to Zechariah says, these seven lamps represent the eyes of the Lord that search all around the world. And we could look at some of the additional vision and imagery, but we're not going to take the time that. But I love this. What are the two olive trees? He said that they represent the two anointed ones who stand in the court of the Lord of all the earth. You see, for Israel, the olive tree sometimes represented the priest and sometimes represented the king, the different parts of the Old Testament. But there are two here, probably priest and king. In many ways, this seems like this is a foreshadowing of the incarnate Jesus, who would be both a priest and a king. But don't miss this as well. Zerubbabel stopped building the house of the Lord. He gave up. I was on the phone with a pastor this morning who said, again, as I indicated last night, I am ready to give up. And the message here is you have laid foundations. It's time to start rebuilding. And quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, we have an opportunity to rebuild. I would hesitate to say that this pandemic has been a good thing because that would be inappropriate, disservice to those who've lost their lives, who've suffered, whose businesses have closed, whose people, whose relatives are now no longer here. But I can say this, it is a new opportunity. When the Jews returned back, that ragtag remnant returned back to Jerusalem, they could look back upon the time of captivity and see all those difficult things that happened. They could look back and see it's been a challenge, but they also knew that the time had come to rebuild the house of the Lord. Ladies and gentlemen, it would seem that we have this opportunity as we move from 2021 to 2022. I'm calling this the post-pandemic church. I guess if this pandemic keeps on coming on, I'm going to have to call it like the little book I wrote, the post-quarantine, because there may not be a post-pandemic. It may be with us indefinitely. But whatever label you put there, where do we go from here? Basically, how do we build upon the foundation that has already been built? Now, first thing I want to do is just talk to you straight. Not try to hold back on anything. Last night, I've told you about some things, and I could see the faces of some of you. You say, not my church. I get it. But we, the people of God, if we're going to rebuild the house of God, we've got to ask God, what do you want us to do? And it may not look like the way we have done it in the past. And as long as it is something that God's word honors and is true to his word, if God says it, we've got to do it. We've got to get ready to rebuild his house. Let me give some just sober statements, and then we'll get into the hope. We have the research right now, and it's pretty evident to see the reality. You see, I am not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. As a matter of fact, sometimes I don't think I have an original thought. But what I am able to do with my team as we do research, we're able to look at dots of data, things that are happening, and we're able to connect those, and we begin to see trends. And we've been watching this quarantine. We've been watching the time of the pandemic, and we're beginning to see some things. One, if you are a typical church, you have lost 20% of your members other than to death and transfer. That's if you're typical. You may be it may be worse than that. But here is the reality. In most of those churches, they are not returning. They are not coming back. We've been watching this trend. We've been watching them. So point number one is I want you to hear this. They are, many of these, from what we are hearing, they are not returning. We continue to survey pastors, church leaders, and they're telling us that there has been this, of course, average of around 20% who left the church and they cannot be found anymore. We'll look at the why behind that as we go to number two. Number two is cultural Christianity is dead. Now, what do we mean by cultural Christianity? Historically, particularly in America, 19th century, 20th century, and early part of the 21st century, being a part of a church was not only culturally acceptable, it was culturally expected. I can remember being a pastor, and I can remember the mayor coming to our church. I can remember key business people. I can remember influencers. And I can remember people who were just wanted to be accepted by others in the town. They came to church because it was their social gathering, and it was also the place where they would get a stamp of approval. Oh, he or she is a good church-going person. Cultural Christianity was very much alive. But you know what? Many of those people were not believers in Jesus Christ. They were there just to be culturally approved, to be culturally accepted. You no longer have to be in a church in the United States to be culturally accepted. In fact, if you are active in a church, you may be culturally disapproved these days instead of accepted. And here's the reality. Cultural Christianity, as early as 2015, made up by our research as much as 30% of the attendance of a church. We're seeing the cultural Christians leave because they don't think they need the church to be culturally accepted, and we don't think that they're coming back. So you have 20% of your members who left, 30% of cultural Christians who will, if they're not part of that 20%, will add to the number. So cultural Christianity is dead. That may be a good thing. It may be that we're actually beginning to see those people who want to make a difference for the gospel that are going to be a part of our churches. Another question that we're asked has to do with the digital streaming worship service. One thing that we're finding for sure is that digital streaming worship will not replace in-person worship. Most of us will celebrate that. We did not know where this would head. Now, that is not to suggest that you don't have a streaming worship service. If you do, keep it, even if the numbers are down, because it is going to be a good place for a mission field. It is going to be a good place if it's used strategically to reach people with the gospel, and that streaming service is now the new front door for guests. The front door used to be the website. That's the second place. The first place is they're going to streaming services to listen to you. And if they listen to me, they wouldn't come. And that's why I'm not a pastor anymore. They're going, many of the guests are coming and starting off in the streaming service. Digital streaming and worship will not replace in-person worship. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to have the digital world as one of our mission arms. Also, we have been watching the finances in 2020 and 2021, and we can say that income is good for now. Income is good for now. However, we are being cautious about this for 2022. We have watched an incredible amount of liquidity injected into the pocketbooks of businesses, into individuals. In fact, government subsidy funds have been at an unheard of rate for 2020 and 2021. And this liquidity has given people extra money that they would not have had otherwise. I'm not making a political statement. I'm giving you a factual reality. Now, what do we see for 2022? If the present trends are continuing, that funding for those who have children or those who took out PPP loans or whatever the case may be, that funding is not going to continue and certainly not at the same level it did. We have found out that one of the reasons that the income has been decent in a lot of churches, not all of them, is because there was new liquidity, which means money, that had not been there before. And the generosity of those who received it gave a portion of it to their churches. So we're saying here, income is good, but we're being cautious. I am a member of my son's church just south of here in Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is the southernmost part of the greater Nashville metro area. 5 years ago, I made a commitment. It was my decision between me and God, not something everybody should make, that I was not going to preach anymore on Sundays at other churches. I wrote a little book a few years ago called I Am a Church Member, and I had not been a church member for a long time. I mean, I was on the rolls, but I would preach in other places. I wanted to be there for my son to help start this church 5 years ago. And as we began to start that church, we began to see the possibilities of what God could do. And it has been a good story. It has been a fun time. I love it when I get up on Sunday mornings, and we don't call it Sunday school. These new churches have to be cool, so they're going to have other names for it. Ours is called community groups. And because we're meeting in a warehouse, there's really no place for Sunday school community group classes except for one, and they let the old people have that one on Sunday morning. I represent the second oldest person in the church. And so the senior adult group begins at 40 in his church. And so we have a senior adult group, and we're the only ones that get to meet in the facility on Sunday morning. So I love getting up and going to my 8 o'clock community group and then going to the first worship service, which is at 9 a.m. And then sometimes my wife encourages me to stay and listen to him preach a second time. He's good, but he's not that good. But Jess, if you happen to be watching this live streaming or you get the recording of it, I love you, but not that much. And when I have to stay twice, it is only because I love God and I am scared of your mother, and I love her too. What else are we finding out? As I meet with leaders of churches and denominational leaders, I'm trying to get this message screamed from the mountaintop, and I call it the critical importance of sustained evangelism. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is we're watching the churches that are beginning to have a momentum, and it is a momentum where the Great Commission is at the forefront of what they're doing, not just periodically for this program or this emphasis. It is becoming a part of their DNA. And evangelism is happening every week. I could give you lots of examples on that, but a quick burst of evangelistic activity is good, but the churches that we're seeing turn around are those churches that have sustained evangelism. Here's the thing about it, ladies and gentlemen. when a church's Great Commission focus and they're talking about Jesus and the gospel is being shared, not only does evangelism begin to increase, but people are made into greater disciples of Christ because they're being more obedient. And fellowship gets healthier. And when people are not looking inward, they don't fuss and fight and feud because they're looking outward, and unity increases. Read Acts 2. It's a pretty good story, especially beginning at verse 41 to 47, where the early church had begun. I could park here, but it's something for just I want to leave with you. What would your church look like if evangelism was a 52-a-week emphasis instead of an occasional emphasis as it is in most churches, or no emphasis at all as it is in some? And let me just for a moment, through our research, debunk a myth. I call it the myth of the antagonistic non-Christian. And here's what I'm saying. I believe the enemy, I believe Satan, has influenced many of our members, whispered to them, you don't need to share Jesus because these people don't want to hear about it and they're going to get mad at you. In our research, we found over 8 out of 10 non-believers were receptive to both an invitation to church and to the gospel. It is a myth to say that people don't want the hope of Jesus. Now, occasionally there will be that antagonistic person. Occasionally there will be that person with a snippy comment. But here's what you need to know. Social media is not reality. And what you read on social media is not the real world. And if you read on social media, you would think that Christians hate each other and the world hates Christians. The time now is to go to the evangelistic harvest fields and see what God will do. I mentioned this last night, and I'm not going to park here, but it's the emphasis of horizontal growth over vertical growth. We're seeing the fastest growth, ladies and gentlemen, in churches under 100 in attendance. That doesn't mean you have to have under 100 in attendance to be a fast-growing church, but we're seeing that the millennial generation and Gen Z are attracted to smaller worship gatherings. And that doesn't mean we should try to get smaller just to reach them. We're going to go through some form of church discipline and we don't have deacons anymore. It just means that the small church, if it is a healthy small church, is not at a disadvantage. And that what also means is, as I talked about last night, if we look at the opportunity of having another campus, doing something as radical as that, or adopting a church, or maybe another service that is not in that Sunday morning bucket, that is horizontal growth. And we're seeing the fastest growth in those areas. Let me look a little bit at the generations as we talk about trends, kind of jumping all over the place. Let's talk about some of the generations. First of all, the builders, those of you who were born before 1946, I love the name of your generation because you built this nation. You built this nation economically. You built this nation with strong morality. You built this nation, for many of you, spiritually. I love that. Then along comes my generation who tried to reverse everything. The builders born before 1946, the boomers born before between 1946 and 1964. Let me just follow some numbers for you, if I will. I don't have the numbers up here, but you can write them down. And I may be off 1 or 2 points here. So if you find that I have missed it from memory, that's okay, but I'm going to be close. The builders, according to the surveys we've done over the years, about 65% of them are Christians. Those that are still living, of course. About 65% of them are Christians. The boomers, we saw the largest one generation drop off in Christianity with the boomers, and about 35% of the boomers are Christians. If you're wondering why culture has shifted as dramatically as it has, it is. You can see it in between the builders and the boomers. We went from roughly 2/3 of a generation being Christian to about 1/3 of a generation being Christian. Then Gen X, born between 1965 and 1979, again, according to our research, about 25% of Gen X is Christian. Millennials, the largest generation in America's history, 80 million of those, 79 million compared to the boomers, 76 million. The millennials born between 1980 and 2000, about 22% of them are Christians. It was lower, but we're seeing that number tick up a little bit. Gen Z, born after 2000, we don't have their faith numbers yet. The youngest of those is 2 years old, and the oldest of those is about 20. And so we're yet to see how this generation is going to fare. What we're seeing in both Gen X and the millennials is the opportunity to reach more people. So what are our challenges? One of the challenges are the boomers, my generation. We often do what we call change receptivity studies. That is a big word, a big phrase, simply to say, in a church, which group resists change the most? It almost inevitably, when we do any type of consulting, it comes to my generation, born between 1946 and 1964. The mantra, the motto of many of the boomers is, we've never done it that way before, so we're not going to do it that way again. And so that has become one of the great challenges that is there. But there's another generation that now represents a big opportunity, and that is Gen Z. Let me just do something real quickly. I want to make sure I finish on time, so let's do this quickly. How many of you in this room became a Christian at age 19 or younger? Would you raise your hand? Now, please keep your hands up. All right, I won't keep them up. I don't want you to get lost. Okay, I want everybody to look around. Do you see what I'm seeing? I'm estimating 90% of you. About 9 out of 10. Okay, you can lose your salvation. All right. Sorry. Gen Z is your opportunity. They're the age that you became a Christian. And guess what? They're not resistant to the gospel. They don't know about the gospel. They don't know who Jesus is, or they have some type of wacky idea, but they are not resistant. How do we reach Gen Z? Have you just tried getting to know them? Ever just tried doing some type of tutoring? Have you ever tried just getting a relationship with one, maybe through a parent or something like that? Here is an incredible opportunity in this post-quarantine or post-COVID era. Now, here's one thing I want you to hear very clearly. If you are going to see sustained growth in this new era, it is going to require four times the level of effort, funding, and emphasis in evangelism than has ever been done in America. I hope you hear what I'm saying. There is going to have to be such an emphasis on evangelism, reaching people with the gospel, like there has never been before. Sometimes we're looking for all the neat tricks and how do we reach people. And there are some cultural issues that we can address. There are some tools that we can use. But basically, the best way to reach people with the gospel is to tell them about Jesus. It's really a radical concept. And what we're finding is churches that are emphasizing this more than they ever have, putting four times the resources, four times the time. Of course, this is an average, four times the emphasis. These are the churches that are already beginning to have breakout growth. So how do I want to end this? I want to talk about this time being a blank slate opportunity. Zechariah 4. Hey, angel of the Lord, I want you to go tell Zechariah to tell Zerubbabel, he has laid the foundation of the house. I want you just to look at this one more time in Zechariah 4. It begins at verse 8. Then another message came to me from the Lord. Zerubbabel is the one who laid the foundation of this temple, and he will complete it. You are the one who've done so much foundational work to help build the house of God. Zerubbabel had given up. He was probably fearful of internal dissension and external opposition. And he stopped building the house of God for about a decade. And then the message got to him. You started it, and now you will finish it. It doesn't say that Zerubbabel laid the foundation and now someone else is going to finish his work. It says he will complete it. And when this happens, what will you know? Then you will know that the Lord of heaven's armies has sent me. Then you will know that God is not done with you yet. We are in an era of incredible turmoil. We are in an era of time that is as tumultuous as I remember in my 66 years. We're in a time of convoluted culture and morality. But God's not done. This post-quarantine era, this post-COVID era, this new time is a blank slate. Take it for that. Look at it as an opportunity. And then see how God will rebuild the house through your hands, through His Spirit and His Word. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time to rebuild the house of God.